fucking soft, I guess.
It's a great pleasure to have Dr. Robert Harris here. He made the very long trip from the 11th floor down here. He's a member of the computing division, also a member of the CMS and CDF collaborations. He got his PhD from Berkeley, then he moved at Fermilab, and here he is. He will tell us about probing new physics with jets at the LHC.
Thank you, Bogdan. It's a pleasure to present to you the CMS plans for probing new physics with jets at the LHC. So this is a study that was done at the LPC. That's the LHC Physics Center. It's a center of CMS physics at Fermilab. It's approved by the CMS collaboration and published in the CMS Physics Technical Design Report, shown right over here. It's also the PhD thesis of two students, Selda Essen, who's now a postdoc for Brown, and Kazem Gamouche from Texas Tech. It's a demonstration of physics at the LHC Physics Center, working in collaboration with the rest of the CMS collaboration. And I'd like to thank my many CMS colleagues whose hard work made this talk possible. So here's the outline of my talk. I'll start very basic and get progressively more technical as I go along, but I like to keep it all at the simplest level possible. After motivation, I'll have an introduction to jets and the new physics we're going to probe with jets. Then I'll discuss the CMS jet trigger and jet backgrounds from QCD and the CMS sensitivity to signals of new physics, such as new particles observed as diejet resonances or new forces observed as contact interactions. And then I'll give you an update on jet physics at the LPC since these results were approved. And finally, I'll conclude. So, in 2008, science will start to explore a new energy scale. 14 TeV proton-proton collisions will allow us to see deeper into nature than ever before. And two large multipurpose detectors will observe the collisions, the CMS and ATLAS experiments at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN at CNIC, Geneva, Switzerland. So, to put it simply, ATLAS and CMS are really big experiments. ATLAS is seven stories high. Here is a person inside the ATLAS toroids for scale. CMS is more compact. It's a mere five stories high. It's a lot denser, twice the weight of ATLAS. Both experiments have thousands of scientists from countries all over the world working hard to prepare for collisions at a new energy scale. And the big question is, of course, what will the LHC detector see? Well, we expect to see the standard model, the pairs of quarks and leptons in three generations, and the force-carrying particles that have already been cataloged. And perhaps we'll even see a Higgs particle that remains to be discovered within the standard model. But we hope to see much more than the standard model. Just this simple picture of the standard model raises many fundamental questions. Why are there three nearly identical generations of quarks and leptons? Like the periodic table of the elements, does this suggest an underlying physics? Is it possible that quarks and leptons are made of other particles? What about the force carriers? Can we unify the forces? The photon, the Z and the W, are already unified, a triumph of the standard model, electroweak theory. Can we include gluons in this unification? Can we also include gravity, which is not pictured there? And why is gravity so weak? So these and other questions suggest there will be new physics beyond the standard model, and we can discover this new physics with simple measurements of jets at the LHC. So you ask, what is a jet? So we have this simple theoretical picture of jets
at the LHC. The LHC collides partons, which contain, the LHC collides protons, which contain colored partons, quarks, antiquarks, and gluons. And then the dominant hard collision process is a simple 2-to-2 scattering of partons off partons via the strong color force, QCD. Finally, each final state parton becomes a jet of observable particles in our detector. And the process is called dijet production. Let's take a look at the experimental picture. Dijets are easy to find. They are the two jets with the highest transverse momentum in the calorimeter. The transverse direction is shown here, perpendicular to the proton beam. The azimuthal angle, the phi is the azimuthal angle about the proton beam, and theta is the polar angle with respect to the proton beam. And eta, the pseudorapidity, is a function of that polar angle. And we're going to study jets between eta of minus 1 and 1, which are well contained within the CMS barrel calorimeter. We can view the jets best if we imagine unrolling the calorimeter in phi and unrolling it in eta, and we make what's called a Lego plot, where the transverse energy of every calorimeter cell is shown as the vertical scale here. And you can see quite, and this is shown as a function of eta, which is this direction here, and phi, this direction here. And here's the region minus 1 to 1. And you can see clearly two jets corresponding to these two vectors emerging in the calorimeter, where a jet is defined as the sum of the calorimeter energy in a cone of radius 0.5 in eta phi space. This is a CMS calorimeter simulation of an event with a dijet mass of 900 GeV. These events are very common at the LHC. To see why, we have to take a look at the dijet rates in cross sections. The rate of an observation is equal to the cross section times the luminosity. And the luminosity is just the rate of protons per unit area in the beam supplied by the LHC. The cross section is found from two factors. One is the parton distribution functions of finding partons in the proton, the probability of finding a parton in the proton with a momentum fraction x. And that's multiplied by a probability of the parton scattering. Then the QCD dijet cross-section that we find here is very, very large. Here is that differential cross-section coming from multiplying these factors as a function of dijet mass. And it's large because sigma hat is from the color force, which is a law of very strong interaction. And we see there are going to be 10 million events at around a TeV. That's about the 900 GeV I showed you before. We'll have 10 million events, just like the one I showed you, at design luminosity of the LHC, which is about 10 inverse femtobarns per month. So this is an enormous background to the new physics that we want to search for. Fortunately, many signals of new physics are also large, either because they have large PDFs. For example, if they're made from the valence quarks of each proton at very high x, you'll find, if they're made from the u and the d quarks, you'll find they have a large probability of finding a u and d quark inside the proton, made primarily of u and d quarks. Or if the subprocess cross-section is large. or if both are large. Well, that speaks about signals. So congratulations for getting through the background. That's always a tough part of the motivation. Let's have an introduction to the new physics with jets, which is a little more fun. Oops. So first of all, quark compositeness is one kind of new physics that we will search for. Three nearly identical generations of quarks and leptons of quarks suggest quark's compositeness. Compositeness is also historically motivated. Molecules are made of atoms. Atoms have a hard nucleus in the center. The nucleons are made of protons and neutrons. These are made of quarks. You don't have to be a scientist to think that it's possible that the quarks are made of something else. It seems almost natural. And scattering probes compositeness. And it's been doing that. We've been doing it this way for a long time. In 1909, Rutherford discovered the nucleus inside the atom via scattering. He scattered alpha particles off of a gold foil, and too many scattered at wide angles to the incoming alpha particle beam. He had hit the nucleus inside the atom. A century later, we can discover quark compositeness in a similar way. We're going to look for more digets, which are in the center of the CMS barrel, than are at the edge of the barrel, using angles. And we'll have more to say about this when we discuss our sensitivity to contact interactions, which is the modern way we search for compositeness. So things haven't changed a lot in 100 years here. The next kind of new physics I want to discuss is digest resonances. These are new particles X produced in parton-parton annihilation, which then decay the partons, giving digets. And the way we see them is as diget resonances. At a particular mass, we end up with a large rate of these digets. The Tevatron has searched for, but not found any diget resonances so far. Here are the published data from CDF and D0 in run 1. Their QCD data distributions, like I showed you on one of the previous slides, compared to either a fit or compared to the QCD theory itself, looking for mass bumps, which you might be able to see here. They're a little faint. This is what CDF would expect for a mass bump shape in its calorimeter. And there are no statistically significant mass bumps over a range up to about a TeV. So why do we search for these diget resonances? What's the point? Well, I like the experimental motivation the best. The LHC is a parton-parton resonance factory in a previously unexplored mass region. With the higher energy, we definitely have a good chance of finding new physics. Nature may surprise us with previously unanticipated new particles. We are exploring. We will search for generic diget resonances, not just a specific model here or a model there. One search can encompass all narrow diget resonances, because resonances that are narrower than our jet resolution all produce similar-looking mass bumps in our data. We can discover the diget resonances if they have a large enough cross-section, basically. There's also a strong theoretical motivation, because diget resonances are found in many models that address fundamental questions in particle physics. We've talked a little bit about compositeness. I'll show you how compositeness leads to excited quarks in a little while. Why are there so many forces? Grand unified theory attempts to unify them into a single force and predicts a W prime and a Z prime. And this decays to pair quark anti-quark pairs, giving digets. Can we include gravity in our description of nature on a fundamental level? Superstrings in grand unified theory attempt to do that, and a superstring-inspired gut model leads to E6 diquarks, which decay to U and D, giving digets. Why is gravity so weak? Extra dimensions has been hypothesized as a way of making gravity weaker than the other forces. And some models lead to Randall-Sundrum gravitons, which appear as quark-antiquark and gluon-gluon pairs, giving diget resonances. Why is electric weak symmetry broken? Perhaps there's a fundamental Higgs, but perhaps it's technicolor. And one model of technicolor predicts a color octet technirho, which decays to quark anti-quark pairs, gluon pairs, giving dijet resonances. Are there more symmetries in nature? Perhaps an extra color symmetry, which could lead to colorons and axigluons, which decay to quark anti-quark pairs, giving dijet resonances. So there are lots of models, and there are therefore lots of theoretical reasons. On the next slide, I'm going to discuss excited quarks. I also, if there's interest and time, at the end of the talk, I have the motivation for E6 diquarks from superstrings and grand unified theory, which might be a little more ambitious to present. And if there's a question about this at the end of the talk, you can see it. So an example resonance model, a simple one, excited quarks. Excited states are very common in nature. The hydrogen atom, where an incoming photon of a very specific wavelength excites the ground state hydrogen atom up into an excited state, and then decays back to the ground state, emitting a photon of the same wavelength. And here is light from the excited states of hydrogen, where you can see the very specific wavelengths, a direct analogy to a mass resonance, if you like, in particle physics. Here's a discrete energy state versus a discrete mass state that comes out. If quarks are therefore composite particles, then excited states Q star are actually expected. Excited quarks are produced when a ground state quark made of prions absorbs a gluon, goes into an excited quark, and then that decays back down into the ground state, emitting a gluon. So it also turns out that the cross section is large, because the interaction is from the color force, QCD. And so a similar number of events are produced as the QCD background. So we hope to be able to see such a thing.
Well, that depends on the mass of the field. That depends on the mass of the excited state.
It depends on the mass of the excited state, but whatever the mass of the excited state is, the interaction that produces it is QCD. No, not QCD, it's colored. And the background is produced by the color interaction. So we expect the signal in the background to have similar overall cross sections. But you're right, their sensitivity, and we'll get to that, will of course depend on the overall mass. OK, so speaking of the background, we're going to go on to a little more challenging part of the talk, the CMS jet trigger and dijets from QCD. So the collision rate at LHC is expected to be 40 megahertz. 40 million events every second. That's a lot. And CMS cannot read out and save that many events. The trigger chooses which events to save. And we have two levels of trigger. We have a level one trigger, which reduces the rate by a factor of 400. And we have a high level trigger, which reduces the rate by another factor of 700. Trigger tables are defined, which specify the trigger, for specific luminosities. We've specified a jet trigger table for three luminosities, which I'll show you in a moment. The luminosities are 10 to the 32 inverse centimeter squared per second, which corresponds to an integrated luminosity of about 100 inverse picobarns for a month of running. And the LHC schedule projects this after about a month of running at startup. Luminosity of 10 to the 33, which is integrated luminosity of 1 inverse femtobarn, the LHC schedule projects these amounts by the end of 2008. Regardless of whether or not the projections of time are attained, this is a month of integrated. This is a month of luminosity at this rate. This is a month of luminosity at this rate. And 10 to the 34 gives you an integrated luminosity of 10 inverse femtobarn, and that's 1 month running at design luminosity whenever that is achieved. So let's take a look at trigger tables that are set up for those luminosities and those sample sizes. So this perhaps may be the most complicated slide in the talk. The CMS jet trigger saves all high ET jets, and it prescales the lower ET jets. Prescale means to save one event out of every n events. This table has three trigger paths, low, medium, and high. Each one of these is a separate trigger on which we're going to get events and separately. The high path has an HLT threshold of 250 GeV. That means we save every event that has a jet with greater than 250 GeV and get a rate of 3 hertz out. The lower threshold triggers, medium and low here, are then prescaled at level 1 to get a rate that's roughly the same as the highest threshold trigger. That's the basic idea. The mass values shown here are then the masses that are efficient for each trigger, which are measured with the prior trigger. This is just one luminosity, 10 to the 32. As the luminosity increases, new trigger paths are added, each with a new unprescaled threshold. So for example, at a luminosity of 10 to the 33, we add a trigger with a threshold of 400 GeV, which will produce about 2.5 hertz, and then we increase the prescales on the previous thresholds by a factor of 10 to again get out the same rate, roughly, from all of them. And then once again, when the luminosity increases to 10 to the 34, we add a threshold at 600 GeV here to get a rate about 2.5 hertz, and we prescale, increase the prescales by a factor of 10 of all the previous thresholds to get the same rate. So that's basically how we set up the triggers. Okay, what samples will these triggers produce? What will they look like? Well, let's take a look at that for the case of the 10 to the 34 triggers. Here in this plot, I showed the expected number of events for 10 inverse femtobarn as a function of the diejet mass, where we're including data from each of the triggers where it is efficient in diejet mass, and we stop analyzing the data from that trigger where the next trigger is efficient in diejet mass. So these are only going to show you the samples that are going to go into our cross-section measurement down here. Really, the triggers all go out in ET, but I've just truncated them a bit. The prescaled triggers shown here give the low mass spectrum at a convenient rate that we can actually measure and take at CMS, allowing us to measure mass down to 300 GeV and overlap with the important Tevatron measurements. However, and the trigger without any prescaling then saves all the high mass digits, so we have the ultimate sensitivity to new physics at high mass. Here we see we expect the highest mass diejet event to be around 7.5 TeV for 10 inverse femtobarn. There's also a plot for 100 inverse picobarns where we expect the highest mass diejet to be 5 TeV. So clearly, we're going to open a new mass reach early in QCD. And then we put the triggers together by multiplying those rates by the prescale to get a cross-section. And here's a smooth cross-section that we can then search for bumps and other signs of new physics. So the question was, a comment was that the prescale trigger would not be used for a cross-section measurement. Yes, the prescale trigger is actually used for a cross-section measurement. It allows us to just sample at a lower rate those events that are coming in at a higher rate, and we're able to then measure the cross-section in that region. So the prescale triggers are used for a cross-section measurement at the lower masses where the prescale trigger is.
Rob, on the same issue. This prescaling is a delicate business because the luminosity varies very quickly with time, so you have to decide whether to prescale somehow automatically. If you do that, then when you have to simulate your experiment, you have to follow all those details, is a big concern.
You're mentioning dynamic prescaling where you may change the prescale values as the luminosity changes dynamically. Eventually, the CMS experiment will reach the point where it wants to do that. But like all experiments, when we start out, we'll do things as simply as possible, and we'll just have fixed prescale values. And this trigger table, which I showed you here, uses fixed prescale values. Good point. Later on, we have to do dynamic prescaling. Okay. So this is the cross-section we expect. What about its uncertainties? Well, there are statistical uncertainties. This is the simplest measure of our sensitivity to new physics as a fraction of the QCD background. What is our statistical uncertainty on our background? These will be less than 3% in the pre-scaled region shown over here. And we see also for this first trigger at 100 inverse picobarns, we're starting the unprescaled sample at 670 GeV. We're looking, there we have the most sensitivity in new physics in a region where we're clearly also overlapping with the Tevatron. I wanted to make that point as well. But then the statistical error bars grow at much higher mass where there are fewer events. And we can see that so we need to go to higher luminosities. And when we go to higher luminosities, we get larger samples, and the statistical error has shrunk here at an inverse femtobarn. And then when we go out to 10 inverse femtobarns, the statistical error has shrunk more. So we get progressively more and more sensitive to high mass objects as we take more data at these higher luminosities. So those are the statistical uncertainties. What about the systematic uncertainties? They're very large for jets. They're dominated by the uncertainty in the jet energy measurement. And here I show the fractional uncertainty on the cross-section as a function of the dijet mass and the uncertainty due to energy scale uncertainty of 5% increases from 30% error on the cross-section at the low masses all the way out to 70% error on the cross-section at the very high masses. Yes, Roger?
So the 5% is something you dialed in, or you actually calculated from testing?
The 5% actually is basically dialed in. It's based on an educated assessment of what we think we can actually do in the first year of running and with the techniques that we've borrowed from previous experiments for how one measures the systematic uncertainties. Yes. 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 Not in detail. It's going to be a detailed study to actually get a number that we can really stand behind based on simulation numbers. This is an educated guess at the moment, but it's the consensus of the CMS collaboration. So this cross-section uncertainty, I want to point out that it changes smoothly. It's correlated with dijet mass. So it should introduce smooth changes into the cross-section if there is a systematic shift, and it should therefore not produce mass bumps, which brings us to the next topic, which is the CMS sensitivity to dijet resonances.
Ask here, so isn't the systematic uncertainty growing with luminosity because you have multiple interactions and other problems?
It does at the lowest values of the dijet mass, but at these high dijet mass values, the uncertainties due to pileup will not be a large component of the uncertainty. There was another question. The question is, what is the uncertainty on the luminosity which goes into there? I think it's anticipated to be roughly of the order of 10% at startup, but it's very, very flat. It will affect all the dijet masses the same. So it'll just change the overall normalization of your expectations, and it won't introduce mass bumps either. So the next topic is, of course, the signal, our CMS sensitivity to dijet resonances. So here's a CMS simulation of dijet resonances and the smooth background from QCD. The QCD cross-section is huge, but it falls smoothly as a function of dijet mass. And I think it's clear that resonances produce mass bumps shown here for three different distinct masses. And we can see them if the cross-section is big enough. So here for a Z prime, which is electroweakly produced, compared to QCD, which is strongly produced, you don't have enough signal. But in the case of the excited quark, which is produced by color, you're going to have enough signal. You can see it right at the peak of the distributions. You have a comparable rate to QCD. Your sensitivity can better be seen on an actual linear scale, which is over here, where I show resonances and the QCD statistical errors. So here is the fractional difference from QCD as a function of dijet mass. And we note that many resonances will give obvious signals
above the QCD error bars, staggering signals. Here, for example, is an excited quark shown in solid for three different mass values compared to the statistical error bars from QCD. And these resonances are produced from the color force, but also axial gluons, colorons, and color octet technirhos are. And we should have a very good sensitivity to all these objects out to very high masses. In addition, we see here E6 diquarks in dashed. These are resonances produced from the valence quarks of each proton. As UD goes to a diquark, goes to UD. And you can see the cross-section rising with respect to QCD as the valence quark distribution of the proton increases its relative fraction of the proton's momentum. So these are obvious things. But we want to know where our edge of our sensitivity is. And we want to know what that edge of sensitivity is for all the resonances. So here is the statistical sensitivity for the diejet resonances. To estimate this, we form statistical likelihoods. They're done for both discovery and for exclusion separately. A 5 sigma discovery means we see a resonance with 5 sigma significance, 1 chance in 2 million of being wrong, 1 chance in 2 million of QCD fluctuating up and giving the resonance. A 95% confidence level exclusion means we don't see anything but QCD. And we exclude resonances at a 95% confidence level. These plots show what those resonance cross-section values are at 5 sigma significance and 95% confidence level. Here, the solid is 5 sigma significance. The dashed is 95% confidence level. And you can see for 5 TeV what the relative size of the signals are with respect to the error bars. And similarly, for 2 TeV and 0.7 TeV, you can see the relative sizes on the same scale. And then we blow it up for 2 TeV, and you can see the resonance with respect to the error bars. And for 0.7 TeV, we blow it up. You can also see here the changing from one trigger prescale to another trigger prescale, how that may introduce issues in actually discovering resonances that are right at the edge. So we're going to actually now discuss what our cross-section sensitivity is overall and compare it to the models. So this is a busy slide, but I'll try to go through it slowly. This is the cross-section shown as a function of resonance mass for discovery at 5 sigma significance, shown by the black curve, and the cross-section for exclusion at 95% confidence level, shown by this dashed curve. And I show it here for one inverse femtobarn, but it's also done for two other luminosities that I discussed. And it's compared to the cross-section for 8 different models. And to summarize, what this plot shows is that CMS expects to have sufficient sensitivity to discover any of the resonance models here that are above the black curve in that mass interval. And we can exclude any of the models that are above, in cross-section, the dashed curve. And if you want our exact mass reach, you just look where the curves cross, where the theory curve crosses the sensitivity curve. Okay. Also, this can be done. You can put any resonance model you like on a plot like this and understand your sensitivity for any resonance. That's what I mean by doing a generic search. Okay. Here is a summary, then, of our sensitivity to the diejet resonance models. So for each model, we show the mass values of the resonances that we're sensitive to, and the range we can discover at 10 inverse femtobarns is shown in red. The range we can discover with 1 inverse femtobarns is shown in green, and the range we can discover with 100 inverse picobarns is shown in yellow. And we clearly see, for example, for the E6 diquark over here, we can discover between 700 GeV and 5 TeV for 10 inverse femtobarns. That's just 1 month at design luminosity. If you worry about when we're going to reach design luminosity, then for just 100 inverse picobarns, we can discover an excited quark between 700 GeV and 2.5 TeV, basically right away. In addition, we have our sensitivity at the exclusion level. So here we have a wider range of being able to exclude these models. And these exclusion sensitivities are shown compared to the published exclusions from the CDF and D0 collaboration in DIJETS. And you can see, for example, we'll be extending many of these exclusions, and we will also be doing it very, very quickly and probing a new mass range very, very quickly. You can see that the models we can discover, we can also clearly exclude. But in addition, we have some sensitivity at the exclusion level to those models that are not produced strongly enough to have a big enough rate to actually discover them. OK. Let's move on to the CMS sensitivity to quark contact interactions. Yes? That's a very, very good question. So you mean this left edge over here? OK, this left edge is actually, it turns out, we actually only ran the analysis down to about 700 GeV. Because at that point, we're starting to run into this prescale trigger too much anyway, and we're losing our sensitivity. The choice is forced on us by the nature of the QCD rate. The question is, what limits the number of prescales? Our ability to handle multiple triggers. We could have two prescales below 700 GeV, but